Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll be interviewing a Christian author who wrote a book examining the intersection of faith and sexuality. Otherwise, it's all Affordable Health Care Act all the time. What are the stakes in last week's Supreme Court arguments? Is the right taking a stand on principle, or is this more partisan posturing? And because there was an overload of comedy responses to the Sandra Fluck, Rush Limbaugh craziness, I'm just going to play some more from The Daily Show.
Well, John, for starters, I think we're focusing way too much on the name-calling and the partisan bickering, because at the end of the day, we can all agree on one thing. Women are either sluts or right? Depending on whether you're on the left or right. Obviously, independents would use bitch.
Well,
they're rebels.
Obviously, they're not the only three words you could.
Oh, right. I forgot whore. I'm such a silly whore.
Kristen Shaw could probably eat a bowl of cereal and make me laugh. With all the furor over contraception mandates in the Affordable Health Care Act, it can be easy to forget that there's an even larger battle going on when it comes to healthcare. And that's over whether or not healthcare reform will even pass through the Supreme Court unscathed. The Supreme Court began listening to arguments last week about the Affordable Health Care Act, and there is a real concern that the more conservative side of the court is going to use this as an excuse to excise huge portions of the law or even overturn it completely. The first day of arguments was about whether or not the Supreme Court should be listening to the case at all. After that was the real show, a debate over the individual mandate. See, starting in 2014, Americans will be required to buy health insurance or pay a tax fine if they don't. Opponents of health care reform are claiming that this is unconstitutional, and supporters disagree. The court will decide. Conservative justices really attacked the administration's lawyer.
Don Verrilli had an hour to defend the central tenet of the healthcare law, that most everyone must have health insurance, whether from their employer, from a government program, or purchased on the individual market. He spent most of that time swinging at fastballs from the court's more conservative justices. Justice Anthony Kennedy was among the first to pitch.
Can you create commerce in order to regulate it?
Though Kennedy occasionally joins the court's liberal wing, today he pushed back hard on the government's argument that Congress can require people to buy health insurance. At one point, he suggested that the law fundamentally changes the relationship between the individual and the government.
It's distressing because Justice Kennedy is the swing vote on the court. In recent years, the notion that the Supreme Court is populated by a bunch of patient, non-ideologues who are willing to hear an argument out before deciding what to think has been thrown out the window. Now they make their likely vote super clear by the questions they ask of their attorneys, and they jockey so fast to ask questions that attorneys barely get to make their case anymore. Honestly, it's getting disgraceful. But it does suggest that Justice Kennedy will, at best, be a tougher nut to crack than many of us had hoped. One thing that's interesting is that now that a bunch of conservatives are attacking the individual mandate, liberals are beginning to actually pull their heads out of their butts and listen to the administration's arguments for it. I remember when a lot of liberals were in high Democrats can do nothing right mode after the public option was regrettably removed from the bill, and they went on the attack against the mandate. Now they're getting why it's important. Rachel Maddow gave us some history on the individual mandate as policy.
1993, when Bill Clinton was president and he was trying to overhaul the health care system, he argued essentially that employers should have to provide health coverage for their employees. Employers were going to be mandated to provide health coverage. The Republican answer to that, the Republican plan, was to say, no, it shouldn't be employers who have to provide health coverage. It should be individuals who take that responsibility. The 1993 Republican health care plan in the Senate included, look at that, something called an individual mandate, a requirement that individuals must purchase health insurance. The author of that plan was a Republican senator named John Chafee of Rhode Island.
To be clear, this individual mandate isn't based in this personal responsibility nonsense. The new law uses employers as the first defense. The individual mandate kicks in for people who don't have employer coverage or aren't on government coverage. Many of them, probably most, will be eligible for subsidies to make sure they can afford it. Why an individual mandate? Well, it's the quickest way to make sure everyone is in the system, honestly. Since insurance companies can't refuse to cover you for pre-existing conditions, there's no penalty for people who aren't sick to hold off getting insurance until they do get sick. If only sick people are insured, the costs are basically astronomical, and you might as well pay out of pocket. The mandate gets rid of the free rider problem. That Republicans used to be for it and now are against it demonstrates how empty the arguments against the mandate are. The mandate is just an angle to give the court a shot at overturning health care reform completely, or making it so unworkable Congress has to repeal it. In fact, the people hanging out on the steps of the Supreme Court seem to grasp that there's no greater principle at stake, just an ideological battle over whether or not we value having a decent health care system or not.
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine.
In the days preceding the arguments, a variety of rallies and vigils were held, mainly by opponents of the health care law. Today, it was supporters who were out in full force. James Winkler is with the United Methodist Church.
Health care is a human right. And that it is a governmental responsibility to provide citizens with health care.
Worth noting is that Republican candidates all promised to overturn the law in its entirety. Not just the individual mandate, but other parts, such as requiring preventive care to be offered without a copay and requiring insurers to cover an employee's children until age 26. This isn't about the individual mandate, and because it's not, I do worry that the court is going to consider overturning the entire bill altogether. After the interview, some evidence from right-wing media that this is about the bill in total and not just the individual mandate. Welcome Amy Frickholm to the program. Amy writes on religion, culture, and spirituality for the Christian Century and other publications. She's the author of three books ranging in subject matter from the end times to medieval mysticism to contemporary sexuality. She's here today to talk about her latest book, See Me Naked, Stories of Sexual Exile in American Christianity. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Amy.
Thanks for having me.
So your book explores the stories of nine people struggling to reconcile Protestant Christianity, you only talk to Protestants, and sexuality. How did you pick the nine people that you cover in this book?
Well, I did not have a scientific method. I started interviewing people because I felt like I needed stories for... I had this idea that I wanted to write about Protestant Christianity and sexuality, and I had a background in interviewing people, and I thought, I wonder if I can use that method for to collect stories for this book. So I started talking to people and uncovering amazing stories. So I just kept interviewing. And then after a while, I had a treasure trove of stories. So then from those, I chose nine, not based on any particular, any particular criteria, but that I felt that they spoke to different aspects of the problem that I was trying to, set of problems I was trying to address in the book.
And when you say that it was Protestant Christianity, is it like mainline and evangelical or just evangelical?
I really wanted to include both mainline and evangelical Protestants. I didn't want to limit myself in either to one or the other, although I certainly don't cover the full range of either evangelical or mainline Christians.
And so what was the kind of focus of this? Like, what was the motivation behind this project?
I think the motivation was really rooted in my own, in the relationship between the body and my own spirituality. And I grew up in a mix of evangelical and mainline Protestant churches, so I'm sure that explains why I wanted a mix for the people in the book. But I knew that... I was having to come to terms with, just to put it in the most basic terms, I was having to come to terms with having a body. I wasn't sure I really wanted one, and it was as I came into adulthood that I realized that, in fact, I don't have a choice. Like, I'm, you know, I, like everyone else, I have one and I have to deal with it. And that wasn't necessarily a happy discovery for me at the time. But I, as I grew to understand why I struggled with the relationship between the body and the spirit, I started looking for resources to understand that struggle better. And one of those resources I came upon were other people's stories.
And do you really, do you feel that that Christianity, at least, obviously that's what your book is focused on, and I'm not suggesting that other religions don't have their own problems, but in this particular situation, do you think that it, it can encourage this sort of feeling that your body is not something that's like a desirable thing to have?
I think so. I think American Christianity is just a great example of how far Christianity can go in that direction. I don't think it's necessarily a problem with Christianity. To indict the religion is not my intention, but to talk about specifically American ways of being Christian, absolutely, the body is a real problem for American Christians. I'm reading a book right now called Seeking the Straight and Narrow that's about both weight loss and sexual reorientation in American Christianity, and it really, I think it really points to the problem of the body in American, among American Protestants.
So you describe the approach to sexuality that American Christianity kind of promotes as straining under a rules-based sexual ethic. What do you mean by this term?
It seems to me that because American Christians usually approach the body as a problem to be solved, you know, like we have these bodies, they're sinful, they do things we don't want them to do, and we have to fix them, then the answer, the way to fix them is to create rules about how they should behave. And so all of our, really all of our body talk in Christianity, as far as I can tell, a huge portion of it anyway, is oriented toward making new and better rules or reinforcing old rules and making sure that everybody is policed within those boundaries. And I think the main effect of this is not that Christians are better rule followers than anybody else. In fact, I think they're particularly good at following rules, but we are particularly good at following rules. But I think that they certainly feel a large amount of accumulation of the failure over time and carry that with them.
Have you ever seen that website, Christian Nymphos?
No, I haven't.
It just strikes me as a really good example. It's a evangelical fundamentalist site, but they're very much focused on trying to promote healthy sexuality within marriage. But even within that framework, which I think is admirable, their FAQ is mostly a list of "Can I do this? Can I do that?"
That's a great example, and there are just dozens and dozens of examples like that. One most recent one that's been getting a lot of press is Mark Driscoll, who's the pastor of Mars Hill Church in Seattle, has just published a book on marriage. And, you know, it's kind of scandalous because it's so vivid and graphic on sexuality. But most of it is also, can I do this? Can I do that? Answering questions about rules within Christianity and marriage. It drives me crazy.
So you just... what would you replace this sort of rules-based sexual ethic with?
I do think ethics and sexuality are really intimately, if I can use that pun, I guess, related. I think that it isn't that I am asking for a non-ethical approach to sexuality. I think that our sexuality is such an important part of who we are. And its expression in the world is really, really valuable and important. We can't have selves without sexuality, and so we need to learn to be good sexual selves in the world. So I'm not interested in becoming the next mainline or evangelical self-help guru on the subject of sexuality. So I resisted for a long time even offering an alternative. I just wanted to critique the rule-based ethic and then let people do, you know, whatever they wanted with it. But I realized that might be insufficient, that I should at least attempt to answer the question for myself. So I attempted to answer it with what I call Well, I articulated four principles in the final chapter of the book that I think could be a more effective way of dealing with the question of a sexual ethic. And to me, those four principles, and I'm not even sure I can remember them because I don't take them as hard and fast, you know, rules, but I think a combination of discernment, awareness, like a really good awareness of the world, of what's going on inside of our bodies and in our relationships with other people, combined with a real respect for pleasure that is missing in American Protestant Christianity, a respect for the pleasure that we experience by being in the world, is a good place to start so that we can then answer questions about sexuality, which are extremely complicated, from a position not of, you know, what are the absolute rules that I need to follow in every situation, but what is my particular circumstance? Who am I sexually? And how do I express that in a world, in the world, in a way that is fundamentally related to love?
So, since you spent a lot of time in this book talking to people that have, to various degrees, felt spiritually abused, what advice would you give to people maybe listening to this and trying to do better and sort of recover from feeling bad about themselves?
Besides, read my book. No, I'm just kidding. Start with reading my book. No, let's see. What would I say? I mean, I think that most of the people that I talk to did have struggles, of course. That's part of what makes their stories interesting. But they also have come to resolutions. Their resolutions are very individual and very specific to their own lives and the nature of their struggles, but they have found ways to recover. And one of my favorite stories from the book is a woman who was recovering from anorexia that was very much a religion-based anorexia, you know, one where she was trying very hard to transcend the world. And she really recovered from that by reclaiming her desires for everything from orange juice to sex. So, you know, she really very carefully reconstructed her world through her desires and paying very good attention to them. And maybe that's not the answer for everybody. Certainly wasn't the answer for everybody in the book, but it's an important answer. Other people found their answers in religious communities and spiritual communities and friendships. Some people found their answers in vocation or calling, you know, a way of what kind of work they needed to do in the world. But everybody really, you know, for the vast majority of people are finding answers. And though the thing that fascinated me is that those answers are changing over time. So even since the book has been published, the people that I interviewed have contacted me with new stories and new ways forward and things that they're doing and ways that their lives have changed. So there isn't one answer for all time.
My guest today has been Amy Frickholm. Her book is called See Me Naked, Stories of Sexual Exile in American Christianity. You can find it online or at your local bookstore. Thanks so much for coming on to RealityCast, Amy.
Thanks, Amanda.
The full-blown hysteria over healthcare reform in right-wing media betrays the claim that this is just about some newly hatched concern about the individual mandate, which, as Rachel Maddow explained in a clip in the last segment, was a Republican idea to begin with. First of all, there were illegitimate slippery slope arguments being offered, comparing the individual mandate with frankly ridiculous laws that don't and won't exist in the future.
Whether or not the federal government can compel you to buy something, in this case, insurance, and if they can compel you to buy insurance, why not health food? Or why not electric cars?
Or broccoli. I
mean, yeah.
Let's be clear. What liberals actually wanted was to handle health care like we do public education, Social Security, or like England handles it. We wanted a single-payer system where it all comes out of a tax levied on all people and everyone can access health care for free. That would have neatly elided conservative claims that they're worried about the government making you buy a so-called consumer item. But because conservatives threw an absolute fit and wouldn't have it, Democrats created a compromise between liberal and conservative positions. Now right-wing media is painting this compromise as some unholy attack on liberty. But it's only there because they would not accept a single-payer system. Interestingly, the former Solicitor General under Reagan shot down the broccoli argument on Fox News.
It's totally bogus because, as Judge Sutton pointed out, everybody isn't in the working out market or in the broccoli market, but everybody is in the healthcare market, or 95% of the population. So they're not being forced into a market they're not in. They're being told, they're being regulated in how they pay for things in a market that they are already in and are sure to continue to be in.
The notion that we can opt out of the healthcare market is a joke. If you think that you can, go try and have a heart attack on a street corner or get hit by a car and see how swiftly you get shoved into an ambulance and therefore into the healthcare market. This law is simply preventing you from calling up an insurance company from the ambulance and getting coverage now that you need it. You have to have the insurance before. It's important to note that while this was a Republican idea in the U.S., this kind of law is common in many countries that provide universal health care with the assistance of private insurance companies. Some conservatives didn't even bother with building up straw versions of the mandate, but instead made bold attacks on health care reform for addressing women's health care alongside men's.
Well, there might be some fallout on free birth control pills. In fact, there will be. If Obamacare is held unconstitutional and college co-eds could face personal expenses, what did we hear, $3,000? $1,000 a year to have protected sex.
Rush Limbaugh is intensely stupid. That's what I've decided. This claim makes no sense in two ways. First of all, the official complaint from conservatives is an objection to the individual mandate. They don't want to pay for insurance by law, which means that they know that people who buy insurance are paying for it, which means these aren't free birth control pills, but like all other medications on your insurance, are covered. The question at hand this time isn't Title 10 or Medicaid, which are untouched in this conservative argument on this case. The second reason Limbaugh is clearly stupid is that his arguments hinge on the assumption that until healthcare reform, birth control wasn't a mainstream part of healthcare coverage, but was instead treated like movie magazines and beer, entertainment items you can buy with cash. In reality, most insurance companies already cover contraception. This law just tells them what percentage they must cover by law, and that's it. This isn't the seismic shift in understanding of contraception care that Limbaugh pretends it is. When I get down, you know I get And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, Uganda edition. American fundy Scott Lively is being sued in U.S. court by gay rights groups in Uganda for breaking international law by inciting persecution of gays and lesbians. He went on the American Family Association's radio show to defend himself. This is quoted at length because it's a very important story.
Uganda, in the 1990s, entered into an incredible Christian revival. And as a result of that revival, the Christian values were just infusing the whole society. And they went from having the highest level of AIDS in Africa to the lowest through the promotion of abstinence and fidelity in marriage. You know, the core Christian values about sexuality. Because they had done this, you know, virtually turned the AIDS problem upside down. Because of that, that represents a huge threat to the globalists who use the sexual revolution and the whole Planned Parenthood Federation and the homosexual, the global homosexual movement. They use all those components as a population control method as they gather more and more power for themselves. So what Uganda did represented a major threat to them. So they began infiltrating the country. George Soros, for example, I don't know what stage of the process, but he went in like he always does, bought media and set up grassroots activist groups. And then starting in the late 90s, early 2000s, these infiltrators started introducing pornography into this very conservative society.
This is all hogwash, of course, but more critically, it's right-wing projection. there is substantial evidence that the real infiltrator is Scott Lively, who spent years in Uganda claiming that homosexuality is the cause of fascism, that it's a choice and not an orientation, and other hateful lies that have led to repeated attempts to pass a law that has the death penalty attached for homosexuality.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.